This is Wallet Activism, a podcast for everyone ready to change the status quo using your financial power. I'm Tanya Hester. I talk a lot in Wallet Activism about learning to separate good intentions from actual impact. Though most of my focus is on steering people away from tasks that don't actually change the status quo and toward ones that are truly impactful. Our guest today, however, wrote a book about not only aiming for real impact, but also looking clearly at the harm we cause when we focus only on our good intentions, especially in a social justice context. The book is The Wake Up by Michelle Mee-Jung Kim. And as soon as I heard about it, I knew I needed to have her on the show because we'd have a lot to talk about. That was before I actually got a chance to read the book. Now that I have, honestly, I struggle to put into words how much I love it. I had planned to share a different interview with you today, but today is publication day for The Wake Up, and I wanted to encourage you to get this book into your hands as soon as humanly possible. I hope you'll run out to your local bookstore to buy it right after you hear this conversation. Little about Michelle. Michelle Mee-Jung Kim is a queer, immigrant, Korean-American woman writer, speaker, activist, and entrepreneur. She is CEO and co-founder of Awaken, which provides equity and inclusion education programs facilitated by a majority people of color team and working especially with the tech industry in the Bay Area. Michelle's book, The Wake Up, is one of the best practical social justice books I've ever read. No exaggeration. It's essential reading for anyone trying to change the status quo, especially if you come from any sort of privileged background, like being white, male, cisgendered, able-bodied, born in the country where you live, and so on. Michelle has a brilliant way of talking about privilege, likening it to ice skating. She describes it this way. Privilege is just the feeling of gliding along without realizing that other people can't get their skates to fit right, they are stuck on a piece of bumpy ice, or they can't afford entry to the rink at all. And she's equally brilliant at helping us understand how to use any privilege we do have for real change, not just to pat ourselves on the back or to get likes on social media. When describing the purpose of the book, Michelle writes, "The language of social justice and the latest list of cultural faux pas will continue to evolve, but what I'm striving to share with you are the things that won't change with the latest news cycle. The fundamentals of the work that will help you create your own list of action items no matter the context, anchor you to be critical in your understanding and approaching of any situation, and enable us to move forward together to create social change." Seriously, you need to read this book. I could go on for hours, but instead, let's hear from Michelle herself.
I think there are a lot of people who have genuine desires for change, that they want to be a part of the movement towards more equity and justice and inclusion and diversity, representation, all the good things. And I think that there are also too many instances of where those good intentions often fail to actually create the change that folks want to see and feel supportive to the folks that want to be the folks that are meant to be supported.
I found a line that you wrote to be so powerful. You wrote, "Good is not defined by the do-gooder." That makes me think of, yeah, all those corporations who posted the black square for Black Lives Matter, but then have very little diversity on their teams and are doing nothing to change that. Really, the good needs to be defined by what changes in an unjust status quo. The question is really, you write that a big problem in this gap between good intentions and real change is our need to see ourselves as good people and to create a permanent identity around that, because otherwise that would mean we're bad people. You argue, though, that good is not a permanent state and it's really a descriptor of the actions we take. So for folks who've thought of themselves as do-gooders or who feel committed to doing good, the folks you just described, what fundamental shifts in their thinking would be most helpful?
You know, I think our society is so good at training all of us to think in binary ways, that we are either good or bad. As soon as we deviate from that goodness, we are then categorically lumped into a list of bad people. And I think that really sets us all for failure because it doesn't leave room for us to make mistakes and to embrace the complexity that we inherently hold in all of us. And so the number one thing that I often start with when we are doing workshops or having facilitated conversations, I blanketly will give people the assumption that we're all here for good reasons and with good intentions, and that we are all innately good in terms of our capacity to be able to do good. And with that, I also remind folks that despite our good intentions, despite our inherent capacity to be able to do good things, we can still make mistakes and cause harm that deviate from our own perception of who we are. And what I often see is our holding on to this identity of being a good person or being a non-racist person prohibits us from being able to receive feedback when we actually have not made a good impact, when something that we've purported to do good with ends up having a harmful impact on the people that we're trying to be in solidarity with. So I think that obsession with being categorically seen as a good person often is a shortcut to not being able to live up to that standard of perfection. And I believe that being good is a transient adjective that is time bound. That's something that is defined by our action at the moment and not something that we can use to label ourselves for eternity.
You mentioned that clinging to that identity causes a lot of us to be unable to admit our mistakes or to be able to say, oh, well, my heart was in the right place or I was trying. Why do you think it's so hard for a lot of us, especially if we do think we're working toward the right goal? Why is it so hard to admit mistakes or to course correct?
I think we, again, as a society, have been trained to associate accountability with punishment. And this is a concept that I really learned from those leading the abolition movement. And in particular, Miriam Kaba talks a lot about this binary thinking and in how in our society, when you've committed something that has been categorized as a crime, then you are either banished from society altogether or you are punished in such a way that people equate that with accountability. So that context, given that backdrop, of course, we're afraid to make mistakes because we fear being punished, being shamed, being seen as not a good person. And we know what happens to those people. So I think that when we examine the conditions that we're living in, I think the fear that people have around making mistakes, the fear people have around failing at something, it's totally understandable because I don't think that as a society we've been good about building in that safety net and the psychological safety for people to actually fail or to make mistakes and to admit that they were wrong. And it takes an incredible amount of courage and vulnerability and accountability and self-trust to be able to admit that we are not always going to be perfect, that we are going to make mistakes, and to know and to trust that we also have the capacity to repair harm when we've caused harm. And for me, it's taken a lot of self-exploration and unlearning habits that have been taught to me from the culture that we both live in. Having worked in the corporate space, having worked in the tech space, where there is a degree of risk to admitting that you are not perfect or giving yourself that room to be vulnerable with one another. I don't think those behaviors, as much as we are talking more about it, is normalized nor celebrated or rewarded. So I think, again, as a society, we need to do a lot of unlearning around the behaviors that are celebrated and accepted, and also be able to trust that not only are we capable of making mistakes, but we're also capable of doing better from learning and unlearning and holding ourselves accountable.
We've talked a little bit already about the corporations posting the black squares. And something that you and I both do is we urge people to avoid actions that are performative instead of impactful. And we see a lot of that performative allyship out there. I'm sure we can all conjure up lots of examples. You write about asking, what is your why before you engage in acts of allyship or activism? And you wrote that allyship's purpose is not to self-congratulate or promote or validate one's virtue. Why is it so important to examine that why?
The why for me is the foundation that anchors all of our actions. And it informs whether or not something that we do is actually in alignment with our why and the values. So it's really the guidepost that we need to have and we need to have clarity around, because we're always going to come back to our why to validate whether or not we should engage in an act or a behavior so that we can verify that this is actually indeed in alignment with our values. I often see people who are activated, newly engaged, and who are excited to engage with the social justice movement, whether that's in the corporate space or in schools or whatever different parts of the society that you're inhabiting, wanting to rush to doing things. And I totally understand that motivation, right? Once you've been provoked by an alarm that lets you know that there is this reality that you've been snoozing on for a long time and people have been suffering, of course, the first thing as an empathetic, good person is to want to do something to change that right away. But what ends up happening when people have not actually examined their why first is that it's so easy for us to engage in actions that end up making us feel relief in that moment, because when we see other people suffer, we often feel guilt, we often feel sadness and anger, and we want to alleviate ourselves from feeling those negative emotions. So we end up engaging in behaviors to, in a way, serve our pain first before really thinking about what it is that we are doing and what we're engaging in that's going to ultimately impact the people that we're looking to serve. So having a grounded why before we engage in reactive action helps us avoid those types of pitfalls. In the book, I talk about three different types of whys for both the businesses and the organizations, as well as for us as individuals. And when it comes to the why that I often see being preached in the corporate space, it's still rooted in the values of capitalism, right? That diversity helps us innovate, be more profitable, and to be able to sell more products to a larger audience. And what I argue in the book is that while those things may be a compelling case for businesses to engage with, ultimately, it's not a sustainable why that can really move the needle on uprooting the systemic oppression that's embedded in the systems. What I urge people to think about is to go beyond the business case. And I think in terms of the interpersonal relationships and for our personal whys, for us to go beyond the narrative of helping other people. And that's not to say that those are bad reasons for people to start engaging with activism, but oftentimes what that ends up doing is a why rooted in our desire to help other people. One, positions ourselves as saviors, right? That somehow we are in this seat of doing good and being able to help those in need. And it creates this power dynamic where it sets us up as somehow morally superior or holding privileges that put us up in a little bit of a higher stance than those who are experiencing systemic marginalization. And so it ends up leading us to be saviors, martyrs, which are not helpful power dynamics. And in fact, it actually sets up that power inequity that just perpetuates the unhealthy dynamics that we're trying to undo. And that type of framing of helping other people who are in need also absolves us indirectly of the harm that we cause and our role in perpetuating systemic oppression, right? So when we say, oh, I am doing this out of the goodness of my heart, it actually erases the fact that no, actually, we're part of the system that is perpetuating inequities and systemic oppression. And therefore, we have a responsibility to engage, not from the goodness of our hearts, but because we are either going to be benefiting from the systems of oppression, or we're also going to be part of the harmed parties, right? So there's no neutral ground that we can stand in from which we can engage with activism on our own goodwill, right? That we're always going to be implicitly and explicitly involved in upholding the status quo one way or another. So I think ultimately the why that I argue is the most compelling and sustainable in the long run is a why that involves all of ourselves and the one that acknowledges our role and our responsibility in the systemic injustices that we see, and that we actually have to see ourselves as being a part of it. And we're not just solving something for other people, but that we're actually doing so because it impacts us and because we're complicit.
I argue flat out in wallet activism that we should get rid of all save vocabulary from our brains, you know, yes. Save the earth, save the children. It's so harmful and positions us as saviors when, exactly as you said, we are often upholders, maybe perpetrators, certainly beneficiaries of certain forms of privilege. And certainly white folks get the most of it in a white supremacist society. So I use the analogy of we need to stop acting like we're the white knights and instead call off the siege that we're creating.
Yes, I love that.
You write about learning how to intervene when you see something bad happening, whether it's police brutality of a person of color or it's a microaggression in the workplace. For those who want to speak up, especially at work, but feel that they'll be penalized for doing so, we know that women are routinely seen as uppity or are denied promotions if they agitate for others, whereas white men tend not to be. If you're sort of in that category of feeling like you'll be punished for speaking up, or maybe you have your own marginalized identity, what advice would you give to them to speak up and make it count without jeopardizing their own safety?
In the book, what I talk about is, one, knowing the boundaries that you will exercise, and also knowing your values, right? So for me, navigating the workplace, both the corporate space and the tech space of different sizes, there were different risks that I took every single day. And some days bigger risk, some days smaller risk. And sometimes I also had to pick my battle in order to survive. And I think it takes a lot of discernment to figure out when certain things are, for me, a choice for me to disengage. I can use a big example that I talk about in the book. So when my co-founder was assaulted by the CEO, and I'm not going to get into the details, there's more in the book, there was real material risk that I took and something that I also needed to give up in that moment, which was I needed to quit my job in order for me to stand by my values. And so I think there is this real repercussion that we often don't really think about for marginalized people. And for people who are trying to live according to their values, that there's going to be moments where we need to make a choice and where we are going to be asked to give up something that is important to us, whether that is our safety, whether that is our stability, our ability to be promoted, and that people are taking these risks every single day. So what I want to leave people with is, especially those with relative privileges, is to understand that these risks, small and big, are being taken up by marginalized people every single day just by their sheer existence. So how can folks with more privileges and power take on that burden so that they could be the ones taking more risks because they also have less to lose and there's a better chance that they are going to be able to raise something without facing repercussions. So I think it's always that discerning act of understanding the situation, understanding the context, what you're willing or unwilling to risk in that moment, knowing your values and your boundaries and exercising your agency, and also having those tools and skill set to be able to engage in conversations without necessarily harming yourself even more.
You describe yourself in the book as too radical for corporate America and too much of a sellout for activist and organizing spaces. I'm guessing that that's something that a lot of folks listening can relate to. I know I could relate to that when I was working. I believe that the idea of what an activist looks like and the standard that that comes with holds a lot of folks back from being able to see themselves as activists because they feel they don't look the part, or they work in a corporate setting, or they feel tainted by the need to earn money, you know, heaven forbid that you need to earn a living. How do you define being an activist? And given the fact that you've worked in corporate America and in tech and haven't just been out at, you know, marches and protests full time, what has allowed you to see yourself as an activist?
You know, this is something that I think a lot of folks, as you said, have struggled with. And I've also been in conversations with a lot of different people. And I think part of it for me is the way that we, again, think in these binary terms, right? We talked about the good, bad binary. And in terms of being seen as an activist, there's also this level of expectation of staying, quote unquote, pure in your politics and in your work and what have you. And I think my work is constantly, and when I say the work, I'm not just talking about the work that I do externally, but also the work that I do internally within myself, is growing my capacity to really embrace everything in between, all the grays, and knowing that we live in an incredibly messy, imperfect world, and that there are so many different contexts that goes with each individual person that is impossible for us to slice into a good, bad, or activist, non-activist binary. And activism, I think, also similar to good, to me, is a transient adjective that, you know, you don't just call yourself an activist no matter what you do, but your action is what defines who you are in that moment. And so for me, what's been really important for me to remember are the words of my mentor and longtime grassroots organizer and activist, Kalayan Mendoza. Kalayan does literal frontline work. He's a frontline medic. He goes to protests and different mobilization efforts and treats people who may be harmed by the police or who may need safety trainings. And he's been in the grassroots organizing world for decades. And he reminds me that the front line isn't just in the streets, that the front line is wherever you're doing the work. And I think it's so important for every single person to realize where their front lines are, and that each person has so much power to create change wherever they are. That even if we are not at a protest today or tomorrow, that there is opportunities for us to create change right from where we are if we practice integrity and the values that we preach that are important to us in real time. And I think those are the opportunities I want people to recognize and take. Because every single day, there are things that we can do to move the needle on the equity and justice fronts, whether that's in the workplace, whether that's in the school system, whether that's in the neighborhood that we're in. I want more people to feel empowered to create change wherever they are versus measuring themselves up to this standard of perfection or purity that is setting us all up to fail.
Oh, that's so great. I just feel very inspired by that. I always like to ask authors a nerdy writer question.
I love writer questions.
Great. I am very excited about my book, Wallet Activism, coming out, but I'm also terrified, even though I've been through book publication before. And I loved what you wrote in the book. You said that for those pursuing social justice work, feelings of fear, anxiety, shame, and inadequacy accompany nearly everyone I know who is trekking through this journey. I found that really validating. So thank you for writing that. But if you don't mind sharing, where are you on the excited and terrified scale?
Oh my gosh. It's the best question. I think right now I am more terrified than excited. So when I was writing this book, I felt this sense of intimacy because it was just me and the screen and my thoughts. And I really wanted to be honest with this book. And that's something that I constantly reminded myself of throughout this writing journey, is that I know I'm not going to be perfect with this. There may be parts that I don't get right, but I'm going to try my best to be as honest and vulnerable as possible, because I think that's the only way that I could write about these things and to show that, hey, I am going to take the first leap of faith in sharing some of the most vulnerable and honest stories that I've not shared in public before, and trust that that's going to be received with the same level of care and vulnerability on the receiving end by the readers. And then, so then I got really vulnerable when I was writing, and it was just, you know, it's fine. This I'm doing the writing. I'm writing. It's just me and the screen. And then it dawned on me a couple weeks ago that this book is going to be read by complete strangers all over the country, all over the world, hopefully. And I had the oh shit moment of what have I done? And I think that's what people who have been practicing vulnerability are familiar with, that oh shit moment. I think Brené Brown calls it vulnerability hangover. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the phase that I'm in right now. And because I haven't heard, this is, you know, pre-launch, and I haven't heard enough reviews from people who have actually read the book, and the later chapters of the book become pretty vulnerable. And so I think I'm having that internal dialogue of calming myself down, that it's okay, that I did the brave thing. And I always remember the quote from Mia Mingus, who's a disability justice that I really admire and respect. And she says, "We can only truly practice courage when we're afraid." So I keep repeating that to myself over and over every single day. So I'm in that phase of the journey where I am terrified of how people are going to receive it, but also because I'm not sure if I'm actually ready to be met by the world in this state of vulnerability. So it's a constant inner dialogue, but also going to therapy every single week, getting mm-hmm. myself mentally prepared, because this is also my first book. And I think the recurring theme is I don't want to let people down.
I feel that sigh in a big way. I think
yeah.
this is good for listeners to hear, because it's good to know that everyone who puts a book out that's really trying hard to change the status quo or change people's mind, it's physically hard and mentally hard to bring these things into the world and, you know, be kind with your feedback.
Yes, please. Thank you. And, you know, I can handle it, but please be kind and know that I have done my best at the time, and I am willing to grow and change, and I hope it's useful. I hope it's useful, and I hope that it's something that is, I don't know, I wanted to write something that's timeless too. I wanted to write mm-hmm. something that feels like something that people can come back to. It's something that helps people reflect. It's something that people can hold on to and feel comforted by and challenged by at the same time. And I think that's the hope that I have. So I'm excited to hear people's feedback. And I'm also terrified. So I'm going to be in my corner crying probably later in the day.
It's a wonderful book. Listeners already know my thoughts on it because I fawned about it in the intro. So this book we've been talking about, The Wake Up, where would you prefer listeners buy it?
I would love it if people can support their local businesses. I think the local bookstores have really taken a big hit during the pandemic. So wherever you are, if you're able to access a local bookstore, I would love for people to support them. And bookshop.org is a good place for folks to be able to do that online. And whenever possible, I also encourage people to support bookstores owned by marginalized people and Black, Indigenous, and POC folks.
That's great. I'll include links in the show notes for folks to find it on Bookshop and IndieBound, which will link you to your local indie bookstore and some links to find bookstores owned by people of color. So what's one book you recommend to listeners who want to be better wallet activists and focus on impact over good intentions?
You know, the book that I would recommend to people right now is a book by Maryam Kaba, who I mentioned, and it's called We Do This Till We Free Us. And it's a book about abolition. For me, learning more about our history in this country and also understanding the uprising from summer 2020 and people's good intentions to want to be a part of the Black Lives Matter movement. I think being part of the abolition movement is probably one of the most urgent and important work in our generation. So I would highly recommend that book. It's incredibly accessible, and it's something that taught me a ton about abolition, but also social justice in general. So I'd recommend that highly.
I will include a link to that as well in the show notes. Michelle Mijung Kim, thanks so much for being with us today and for sharing this book with the world.
Thank you so much for having me. This was so great.
One of the things that struck me most in the conversation with Michelle is that she's still hopeful. She still believes real change is possible, despite having witnessed a lot over the years that would make anyone cynical. I understand why people get cynical, and it's a question I get a lot. What can we really do, especially when there's so much overwhelming info out there about environmental and social injustices? A passage in Michelle's book provides the perfect answer. She writes, "I realized that my cynicism about people's intentions and their ability to transform had made me a terrible agent of change. I realized that we can and must be critical, angry, and compassionate all at the same time to keep ourselves from getting stuck and to allow ourselves to hope, heal, and forgive, not just for others, but for ourselves too." There's no toxic positivity in here, no blurring of the nuance. Michelle is completely clear-eyed, but still hopeful and pragmatic. Have I mentioned yet that you need to read The Wake Up? Ugh, I just love it. One of the core themes of wallet activism as a practice is learning to see through the lies we're being told by marketers, and often even by people we see as on our side. Because we're getting to podcast wrap-up time, here's a lie you've probably heard over and over from podcasters, most of whom have no idea they're lying to you, by the way, and they're just repeating what everyone else says on their podcasts. It's that request that everyone makes to rate and review their show because it helps other listeners find it. You've heard that phrase a million times. It helps others find the show. That's completely false. The top charts are based solely on downloads, and Apple and other podcast providers decide which shows to feature and promote based on other factors, and often by being paid by the podcast distributors. So it's really paid advertising, which isn't to say you shouldn't rate and review shows, because most hosts look at those reviews and they mean a lot. Seeing new reviews absolutely makes my day, and there are probably some listeners who do read reviews before deciding whether to listen. So I hope you will rate and review the show, but know that that's more a way to say thanks to me and other podcast creators than it is about helping to spread the word. So as always, wallet activism is ad and sponsor free now and forever. If you want to support the show or my work, you can pre-order Wallet Activism, the book, or request it from your library. And I have links to do that in the show notes. You can, of course, also rate and review the show on your podcast app and tell as many people as you can about the show. That's how we actually spread the word, by spreading the word. You can send me questions at media@tanyahester.com. That's TanjaHester.com. Or you can tweet at me or find me on Instagram at @our_next_life. On my Instagram today, I'll share a picture of how many flags I put in The Wake Up because I was inspired by so much of it. I have a new show coming next week, but make sure you're subscribed anyway so you don't miss new episodes. And until next time, remember, you have real power.